This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Last week on Radio EcoShock, we looked at our growing group of activists, authors, and scientists who say only a serious economic crash could save us from climate doom. Now we'll talk with the man who started this flurry, the co-founder of the permaculture movement, Australian David Holmgren. I'll follow that up with reaction from Canadian finance and alternatives expert Nicole Foss. Will a crash save us? If you care about the future, this is radio you won't want to miss. Despite the hopes and warnings of a generation, humanity is heading for the darker path of more fossil fuel development. Today's politicians are all about new pipelines, fracking, tankers, super coal mines, Arctic drilling, and of course, endless oil. It didn't have to be that way. We had other choices. But now the co-founder of the permaculture movement says, welcome to the brown tech future. That train to climate disaster must be derailed for us to survive, he says, in a provocative essay called Crash on Demand. When it comes to David Holmgren, you've either heard of him in an almost reverent way, or you haven't a clue. Along with Bill Mollison, David started the permaculture movement back in the 1970s. He's experimented with it ever since, from eco-villages and food forests to retrofitting suburbia. His 2002 book, Permaculture, Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, is the manual. David is not a huge self-promoter. Outside of Australia, he's known mainly by people seeking alternatives to the system of endless growth and pitiless pillage of the land. David Holmgren, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's good to join you.
I'd like to get right to work on your essay, Crash on Demand. We'll assume that most of our EcoShock listeners know what permaculture is, although we're always learning about that. You also come from the peak oil movement. Could you explain the progression of the three essays that lead up to this present one?
Yes, well, the Future Scenarios work, which was initially put up as a website by permaculture colleague Adam Grubb, who actually started Energy Bulletin that became resilience.org, of course, in 2008. And then a couple of years later, I wrote an essay, Oil versus Money, Battle for Control of the World, which sort of really enlarged on some aspects of the Future Scenarios work. And then the Crash on Demand essay, the latest one, which there's been quite a lot of response to, was really calling the fact that of my four scenarios, the brown tech future seems the most predominant one in the world at the moment. Those original four scenarios were not what I call necessarily long-term futures for humanity. They were snapshots of that they would emerge over the next 10 to 40 years. And they, you know, might be stable for, you know, a decade or quite a few decades. But they're all characterized as being energy descent scenarios. So that future scenarios work was nested in the larger claim that I made in Permaculture Principles and Pathways, my major work on permaculture, which was published in 2002, really saying that permaculture design principles are a sensible adaption for a world of energy descent, where there's less resources and energy for each succeeding generation on the planet. Not necessarily by some smooth gradual process, but to distinguish it from the what I call the techno-stability scenarios of mainstream environmentalism, or the collapse scenarios, which has been used very loosely to sort of really mean the end of civilization and maybe even the end of a planet that could support human life. So I've been, I suppose, along with John Michael Greer, prominent in promoting this idea of the energy descent future. So my scenarios are nested within that, but at the extreme, the green tech future scenario and the lifeboat, they do verge on the edges of being energy descent into, at one end, techno-stability, and at the other end, into what I would call genuine collapse. But this word collapse is, you know, so loosely used and in relation to all different systems that it's sometimes hard to get the nuance of where different commentators are coming from.
You seem to be saying in your new essay that we've missed the boat on green tech and earth stewardship. Do you have any idea why that is?
Well, firstly, my scenarios are not primarily driven by political or ideological or value decisions by people. They're sort of largely outcomes of what humanity's done in the form of peak oil and climate change, but they are not necessarily, they're not scenarios that we choose. So the green tech scenario inherently was one of slow decline post-peak in oil supply and one of relatively benign or slow onset of climate change that allowed a lot of time for both mitigation and adaptation. Now, it's really on the climate change that we seem to have missed the boat in that regard. And you could say it's because we didn't sort of do anything substantial since Kyoto in 97, the Kyoto Protocol, or going back further, that we didn't really start to restructure the world radically as a result of the evidence of the Limits to Growth report in 1972. But another part of that is that the science on climate change has actually not been very good, at least in the mainstream IPCC stuff, at predicting how severe and intense the erratic weather footnote of climate change predictions going back 20 years, there was always this footnote, increase in extreme weather events. And those increases in extremes are what human systems, like natural systems, are most vulnerable to. The focus on average global temperatures is a classic sort of scientific measuring baseline, but it doesn't tell us much about what we are likely to face. So I think most people in the climate area, while focusing intensely on the doubt raised about the science by denialists, seem less willing to acknowledge that actually it looks worse than what the predictions have been. So that just naturally puts us into the brown tech world where you have this combination of relatively rapid onset of climate change and the relatively slow decline in oil. And that sets up some conditions that then human systems, everything from corporations, nation states, global governance structures, right down to households and individuals, are forced to respond. And that's what, you know, creates that brown tech world. And in the future scenarios work, I suggested that two more severe scenarios of earth steward and lifeboat, it was very hard to see how they could emerge directly from the globalist industrial world that we've been living in. That the effectively to go from where we've been to there would be experienced as catastrophic collapse of civilization. Even if, in the longer term, they weren't. But they would be very severe. What I suggested, a more likely pathway, was where green tech would segue down into earth steward and brown tech might drop more precipitously into lifeboat. So the nuance in those scenarios is quite complex, and I think inevitably some of the discussion that's happened about my latest essay has been in a context where people get part of what I'm on about with these four scenarios, but in other ways they don't necessarily, you know, have seen the subtlety or the nuances or the factors in them that are independent of human choice.
And you've taken another step. I mean, I'm seeing the whole world really going for fracking. It's happening in Canada and Britain and, of course, America. Everybody's counting on it to save national governments from immense debts. They're counting on it. Will it work? And also, I want to point out that Australia is committing to far more coal production. So, David Holmgren, can this fossil-powered engine of self-destruction be stopped? And what is your suggestion on how it could be stopped?
Well, firstly, those are some of the strongest signs that we are in the brown tech world, where the responses to economic contraction, high energy costs, and unstable climate all involve very large resource extraction projects and infrastructure development projects, which all collectively further accelerate greenhouse gas emissions. So ironically, in this brown tech world, there's not actually much concern about climate change at the top level. In fact, it all ends up accelerating it further. But the fact that the money flow has continued in spite of the shock to the system in 2007-2008, the flow of capital from the banking system into the resource extraction industries, the coal industry, the oil industry, has accelerated. And that has meant they've just managed to keep the supply end up in combination with the contraction in demand, which has happened because of economic contraction. So that is, again, the classic extended slow decline in energy production. Of course, underpinning that is a much stronger reduction in net energy production. But all of these responses are completely destructive to humanity's long-term future, let alone that of any other life forms on the planet. I believe the only thing that will stop that is a failure in the flow of capital, because none of these things can happen without the signal that capital provides. And once capital flows stall, then all of the other logistical systems that are necessary to even deliver any of these resources or maintain existing systems are vulnerable to actually stalling. Even though we could say, oh, well, there's actually plenty of resources for the time being, sustain basic human systems. But it doesn't necessarily mean that will occur because of this interlocking we now have with the financial system and with very complex just-in-time logistics and all of the other novel features of the global economy. So the stopping of that financial system, of course, is just a human construct that depends ultimately on faith. To some extent, faith of the billion or so middle-class people who have some savings and some assets around the world, and then faith of a smaller set of money market managers, which really represent, you know, relatively small numbers of people, and the people they serve, you know, the genuine global elite, if you like, the 1% or less. So that faith is something that can be turn on and turn off according to factors that are completely in the psychosocial domain. Therefore, they are amenable to influence by factors within that psychosocial domain. So this is this enormous vulnerability, but I don't believe, you know, there's a sort of a policy mechanism by which nation states will say, oh no, you know, Australia will just leave the coal in the ground. We'll choose to do these things. I think that, yeah, that seems that there's so much evidence now that that's not going to happen. And all of the effort to sort of try and get mass political movements to make that happen are sort of predicated on a notion of, oh, well, once you get a majority of people, or at least a majority of people in affluent countries, to agree, then this will somehow happen. But we have plenty of evidence from recent history that that's not the case. Getting a simple majority on something is not necessarily what's necessary to change a system by deliberate intent.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with David Holmgren. And David, I've had scientists on the program who agree that only a devastating crash of the current economy can reduce greenhouse gases fast enough to make the difference that we need, but it's not a popular idea. How has your essay, Crash on Demand, been received?
Well, I think within the circle of people who pay attention to these issues, it's ranged from, yes, that's self-evident and obvious and has been for a long time, through to great dismay and perhaps even a sense of betrayal by people who are working very hard at trying to get the small-scale initiatives like transition to scale up into mass popular process, but perhaps more importantly, get support at the policy and political level for those initiatives. Because clearly, if you're trying to argue to politicians and policymakers that this change to relocalization of economies, to frugal living away from consumerism, to reducing debt, all of these sorts of things that are actually the obvious sensible strategies for people to pursue, that this is actually a mortal threat to the growth economy. And, you know, there's many people, of course, at various levels saying, oh, no, it's not. In the same way that a lot of people who've promoted the very rapid transition to renewable energy saying all this can be done without actually really adversely affecting a growing economy, somehow the economy can grow without growth in energy and resource use, or that can be done in ways that somehow are completely carbon neutral. So there's already a huge scepticism in established and conservative circles whether it is possible to make any of these changes without risking crashing the economy, or at least crashing the financial system. And of course, as I said before, because the financial system now has grown so large and complex and is such an overriding governance structure on the underlying material economy, those two things are increasingly seen as probably the same thing. A crash of the financial system would create a crash of the material economy. So, yeah, the reactions at that level, have been quite varied. There's also been the warnings, of course, that by saying this, you are inviting blame for it when it happens, and this scapegoating process, which, of course, I addressed that in my essay as well, because I've been well aware that as things unravel, it's quite natural for marginal groups, and including people who've been warning of the crisis, getting the blame for it. And that's why I was sort of very careful overall in the essay to, show the conclusions. But, I think the reaction's been very, very good and very interesting, and it's brought out various other nuanced positions. There's been some aspects of what I've intended that haven't been discussed so much, but maybe those discussions will still emerge.
It's been a long haul for you, David Holmgren, 38 years of pursuing permaculture, and I'm wondering now at this time in its life, if it isn't really more in the lifeboat position, the people who are doing it are thinking to themselves, well, if this does fall over, or even if it doesn't, this is a better way to live. But what's your reaction to that?
Well, there's always been these aspects of permaculture. Back in the 70s, many of us thought that as soon as the market understood the effect of depleting resources, that it would price in higher prices, and this would lead to rapid social and economic transition. Back in the 80s, we thought this would happen. There were also, fairly naive versions of people's notions of lifeboat survival. These were part of the discussions that were going on in the 70s. They then became very unfashionable in the 80s, and they've, come back quite strongly. Now, of course, that's used as some of the evidence that, we've heard all this sort of doom and gloom before. And the whole issue of people's motivation for permaculture, from personal lifestyle choice to symbolic rejection of the values of society, through to providing models for which benign social evolution might occur in the future, through to lifeboat survival, have all been motivators for different people at different points of their journey with permaculture. So I see it's a very complex, multi-layered set of motivations, but part of me sees the question of whether permaculture is a political strategy. It hasn't been seen as such, and I think that's been part of its strength. But it's also led to people who work at the big end trying to change policy, trying to change the wider society. I've often just sort of seen permaculture is over there as a little lifestyle thing. Yes, it's symbolically trying to change things, but it doesn't really deal with any of the hard issues at the scale that's necessary. And then the step beyond that is to regard it as a selfish thing, that it's, yes, like looking at creating your own lifeboat while the rest of the world sinks. But I think those sort of perspectives have, over decades, have missed the point that the success of permaculture is because there is a core of self-interest. But this is a better way to live for people right now, for those who have the energy and the motivation to, if you like, swim against the tide and create their own world. So permaculture from the beginning was really informed by that we want to create the world we do want rather than fight against the world we don't want. But in creating that world, it's not through atonement for our past sins. It's because we're going to get something beneficial from this. And immediately you articulate that motivation or that evidence, a lot of the political activists immediately see that, oh, well, that's just self-interest, and therefore it's not actually of any validity or use in bringing about wider societal change. But I've argued that you must start with a framework where the early adopters, the people who make the most difficult change against the psychosocial norms, actually get a benefit from it. Because that's the positive feedback loop, you know, that we say in the permaculture principle, obtain a yield. You've got to get some benefit from what you do. It's the same basic logic that people understand in small business or people who are farmers. You know, there's got to be an immediate return to say, well, let's do it again. That worked. And then when you have that developed at the sort of household and small scale, then other people can copy that because it's at the same operational scale to them, and they don't require approval by government or financing by banks, because it's something they can actually do themselves. And that small-scale replication, if that takes off to any degree, that creates a cohort of people who then have some sort of political bargaining power and also can be a model for larger scale change. Whereas when you try and change things from the top in a radical way, I think there's evidence from the history of social revolutions and the evidence from systems theory that it doesn't work. It all goes awry. And so you have to start with simple systems that work and scale up. So whether you're talking about a personal lifeboat, a model for viral replication, which will change the world in a positive way, or viral replication, which will pull a destructive system down, or replication which reaches a scale that allows political negotiation with powers that be, any way you look at it, these same strategies work. So it's not about, and this is the key thing, it's not necessarily about saying, oh, we're moving into a lifeboat world or we're in the brown tech world. You've got to have strategies where you can adapt and work within all those scenarios. And I think there's a lot of people who sort of recognise that, you know, permaculture and related strategies. In saying permaculture, I'm not doing that in an exclusive way to, you know, deny a whole lot of related activism and activity that, you know, might not have the label permaculture on it. But this bottom up, do it yourself, do it for your own good, do it for the good of the wider community and the wider planet, that those types of strategies do have potential power, and that it's a message that I'm trying to get those who have poured their life's energy into trying to get political change might see that what we're doing over this side of the fence might be worth contributing to, given how dismal mainstream political change really looks now.
Well, as we wrap up for now, how would you advise listeners to find your work? Could you give us your website and maybe one or two books that they could be reading?
Yeah, the website's holmgren.com.au, and there's quite a lot of my work available on that. There's also the Future Scenarios book, and of course, my major work, Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, is really the thinking tools behind the whole permaculture movement that people are saying can be applied in any context, anywhere, whether you have land or not. And that's now available in quite a few different languages, and there's further translation work happening on that.
From Australia, we've been talking with the co-founder of permaculture, David Holmgren, designed and guided new villages, and he's inspired thousands of perennial food forests around the world. You can look up David and Crash on Demand to find the work we've been talking about, or you can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.info. And David, I have to say, that was some powerful stuff you just delivered. I'm going to spend a couple of times, maybe listen to it twice, to really parse out what you just said. Thank you so much for reaching out to our listeners.
Thank you. And thank you for your work.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Linking up your life to the hurricane that is the big picture, this is Radio EcoShock. Stay tuned for analyst Nicole Foss. Here's another quick electronic ditty I wrote for the climate crisis. Go ahead, send me links to your songs. My address is radio@ecoshock.org.
Farmer, farmer, rains don't come. Farmer, farmer, fields are flooded. Farmer, farmer, crops are wilted. Never that way before the change. City basements fill with water, city seniors dead of heat. City never knows what's coming after the change. In all times of constant seasons, our kind knew the steady clock. Now it's topsy and it's turvy, winds don't blow or never stop. Old folks find it all so strange after the change. Children, children, times of trouble, we don't know until it's done. Airstreams shift until they double, Arctic storms and pounding sun after the change. In old times of constant seasons, our kind knew the steady clock. Now it's topsy and it's turvy, winds don't blow or never stop. Old folks find it all so strange, after the change, after the change.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Can we save ourselves from the worst of climate change by helping an unstable economic system to collapse? That's the idea put forward by permaculture founder David Holmgren in his paper, Crash on Demand. Our next guest wrote a deep and provocative article about Holmgren, climate change, and a crash. She travels the world from New Zealand to Europe giving lectures, which are now available as a 4-hour DVD set. Nicole has been a specialist in nuclear safety in the UK. She's been the editor of the Peak Oil Journal, The Oil Drum Canada. Now she's co-editor of one of the net's more popular financial blogs, theautomaticearth.com, where she writes a stone lay. From her homestead in Ontario, Canada, Nicole Foss, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Your article, Crash on Demand, A Response to David Holmgren, it kind of stunned me. You brought out some of the themes I've heard from you before, but somehow this time it all came together for me, and frankly, it scared me. Did you get that reaction often?
I think so. I got a whole wide range of reactions. Some people, I think, really understood what I was trying to say. Other people just picked one or two lines out and took it out of context and seemed to think I was saying something that I wasn't saying. A number of people said, oh, you're just a climate denier, for instance, and that wasn't the point of what I wrote at all. I'm most certainly not a climate denier. I was just trying to put that aspect into a broader context and look at some of the psychological issues, the drivers for behavior change, and to say, you know, if you want to do something about climate, what are the best ways of doing it? And some of those are a bit counterintuitive. So I think it was a long piece, and it really did take looking at to see what I was actually trying to say, and not everybody really grasped that, I think.
Yes, you have to read all the way through it. And you do say the best way to deal with climate change may be to stop talking about it, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, for listeners who missed it, would you like to take a shot at explaining the main points of Holmgren's paper, especially his four scenarios?
Well, he's basically looking at four different possibilities. So there's brown tech, green tech, earth steward, and lifeboat scenarios. They operate at different scales, and they imply different mechanisms and degrees of control. And originally, he just looked at these four possible scenarios. They're energy descent scenarios, basically. Originally, he just presented the four scenarios. What he did more recently is to say that he thinks it's going to be the brown tech scenario, which is the large-scale state control command economy, looking at brown tech, which would involve nuclear, fracking, all the sort of desperate means of scraping the bottom of the barrel for more energy, which all would have to be done at a very large scale because it's very capital and energy intensive. So he thinks now that that is the scenario that's actually shaping up. And so his point was, if that's where we're going, then maybe we should think about trying to undercut the means for that to happen. So he was talking about the potential for promoting a financial crash. So his idea was that if 10% of the middle class population opts out to do the same things he's always told people to do, he's not telling people to do anything different, he's just putting a different focus on it, to say opt out, be more self-sufficient, don't participate in that larger economy, and if 10% of the middle class population were to do that, he argues that it might crash the system and therefore deprive it of the ability to do some of the worst things in terms of scraping the bottom of the barrel that it might otherwise do. So that was the thrust of his paper.
Well, something new from Holmgren, I think, is his idea of nesting these four futures so they could happen at the same time at different levels of society. Could you talk about that?
Yes, and this is something I very much agree with. Because they operate at independent scales, you can see various aspects of them unfolding at the same time. So the brown tech is the largest scale, and that would be national. And then, for instance, lifeboats at the other end of the spectrum is very small. It's like household sort of level. And then there, you know, community level for Earth Steward and perhaps regional for green tech. And they can happen at the same time, but he's looking at which would be the dominant scenario. And because brown tech, if it is actually fully empowered to operate, would be operating at the largest scale and would suck in the majority of the capital and energy that was left, he was saying that would come to be dominant. Now, I have written about nested scenarios a number of times before. I write about fractals in markets and cycles. I wrote a paper called Fractal Adaptive Cycles in Natural and Human Systems some time ago, looking at how you have changes in cycles in the natural environments that nest within each other at different scales, changes in socioeconomics, cycles that operate within different scales. So everything in the socioeconomic field, everything from very small scale fluctuations within, say, a day that traders would work with, up to very large scale fluctuations that amount to the rise and fall of empire, and everything in between happening at the same time. So I think there's a lot of correspondence between that view and the way that Holmgren is thinking about his scenarios.
So why, Nicole Foss, do you now say that peak oil is not the immediate pressing problem that we expected by 2014?
Because the financial crisis is a shorter-term driver. What happens in finance can unfold extremely quickly. We saw, for instance, this week, news came out about, well, the markets fell for a little while. Then we heard news of HSBC denying depositors large-scale withdrawals. And by large-scale, that was, say, 5,000 pounds. So not enormous scale, just the kind of thing that even an individual might possibly want to do. And they were being denied the ability to do that. All of a sudden, you're seeing headlines on deflation, on panic, on fear, and all of that happened in a week. Now, that's where you get the shift in trend change, because psychology is the driver. It can flip on a dime. It can move things very, very quickly. And I think when you start to see fear in the ascendancy, fear can drive financial contraction so much more quickly than any change in supply or demand for energy that finance is the primary driver of contraction. Now, energy is the primary driver of expansion. The available energy, the surplus energy that you get from a high energy profit ratio, is what drives expansion and the development of socioeconomic complexity. But then if you can no longer sustain that level of energy surplus, you can no longer sustain the economic complexity that was produced by it. So finance ends up being the trigger for that crash to a simpler level of society. So it takes the pressure off energy for a while. If you look what's happening in China, where they're absolutely teetering on the brink at the moment, their demand is already down. Their demand could fall substantially because they've already overbuilt all the infrastructure they could ever want. That is going to have knock-on effects on commodity demand. And when commodity demand falls, you have a gap that opens up between supply, which is geared to the previous level of demand, and the new lower level of demand. When you have a temporary glut, it takes the pressure off prices. It takes the focus off energy supply and demand being tight, which they still very much are, but temporarily a gap will open up that just has people take the focus off it completely. We saw this with natural gas already. We saw the perception of glut in natural gas crash prices to about a third of the break-even cost for production, which has now wiped out a raft of the gas industry in the United States. Now we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing the price spike. But it's critical to understand those psychological dimensions that can play out so quickly, and those really end up being the primary drivers. So it's not that energy won't be an issue. It's that the focus will be taken off it temporarily while we're dealing with financial crisis.
Right, and you talk about how quickly things can change, and you bring up someone I hadn't heard of before, David Korowitz. He's written a paper called Trade-Off, Financial System Supply Chain Cross-Contagion, a Study in Global Systemic Collapse. How does Korowitz fit into our future?
David Korowitz is a superb systems thinker, and everyone should go away and read that paper. He's looking at the dependencies and interdependencies of different supply chains, and how when you start to have this kind of sharp contraction, you can disrupt those supply chains very, very quickly. And that is an enormous impact on the real economy, because these are supply chains that supply the most essential things that all of us need all the time. Our systems can't cope with a disruption that lasts a month, maybe more. People get awfully hungry in a month if you've disrupted the food supply, for instance. We came awfully close in the United Kingdom in the year 2000 to seeing something like that play out, not because of any actual shortage, but merely because of a trucker's protest at high fuel prices. They blockaded the refineries, and in 3 days, they almost crashed the supply chains in the United Kingdom. They almost caused cascading system failure. So things like that can happen very quickly, and then picking up the pieces thereafter can take a very long time. And we may not have that long a time before we start to see real pain in the real economy. So everyone should be aware of those risks, and David's work is very important.
You know, I am concerned. We all are now. We see what's happening in the Ukraine and Syria and Egypt, and then we hear of the grave currency devaluations happening in many developing countries. I'm wondering, are we too worried? Is the financial dragon just shaking a little bit, or is it really, really ill?
Oh, it's really, really ill. It's been ill for a long time. And what we've been doing in our global credit Ponzi scheme is running on fumes, essentially. And those fumes are fraud and corruption, ill-gotten gains. And that's really all that keeps the financial system going at the moment, is that incredibly predatory handing of money to the 0.1% at the expense of everybody else. But that can only keep going for a certain amount of time. We're already seeing just a slow-motion train wreck on Main Street in North America and in many other countries as well, where for ordinary people and, say, municipal governments, the squeeze has been absolutely relentless, and it is just starting to pancake the pile of human promises that we have built for ourselves. And when people wake up to the fact that there are far more claims to underlying real wealth than there is actual underlying real wealth, then you get a massive grab for the underlying collateral. So we have a crisis of under-collateralization. When people realize that and grab for the collateral, then they realize there's not enough to go around. The grab gets bigger, and most people are just out of luck. That's really what a crash leading into an economic depression looks like. And we are teetering on the brink of that at the moment, and it can unfold very quickly when it does happen. It could equal capital controls, loss of access to bank balances, a crash of the value of stocks and potentially bonds, debt instruments of all kinds that are not seen as absolutely gold-plated. We've already seen a crash in gold and silver. I think we're going to see a crash in the price of oil temporarily because the perception of glut because of unconventional oil is about to do to the oil industry what it's already done to the gas industry. So people are going to be taking losses across the board in a period like this. It's something that we've been trying to explain to people at the Automatic Earth for a long time, to say this is what's coming. And if you disengage from as wide a range of dependencies as you can to some extent insulate yourself from this. And this is very much what Holmgren was talking about as well. It's a question of trying to disengage, build local resilience and local self-sufficiency, and that's your best bet in terms of dealing with a period like this.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith with our guest, Nicole Foss. She's a hybrid expert, really, on energy, the economy, and alternative living. As you say, deflation, the devil of big depressions, is hitting Europe already. We know the banks are insolvent without continual government buyouts. Let's say the financial system, Nicole, hits a big bump and that lasts for more than a year. How does that change, potentially, greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, if you have a very sharp fall in economic activity, greenhouse gas emissions should go down substantially. This is what happened in the Soviet Union when they had their collapse. Now, I'm stretching the memory banks here, and I don't have a specific reference, but from what my memory is telling me, emissions fell by about 25% in a year. So correct me if I'm wrong, people who have more access to recent data. But I think we're going to see emissions fall substantially. However, because CO2 has a long residence time in the atmosphere, even if we cut emissions to zero tomorrow, we would still be dealing with whatever climate issues we have baked in the cake already. Plus, particulate matter responds far more quickly. So when you have a reduced amount of economic activity, you're likely to reduce global dimming far more quickly than you reduce global warming. So global dimming is the screening out of instant solar radiation through particulate matter in the atmosphere. Volcanism does the same thing. So you could reduce global dimming substantially while leaving global warming to continue to accelerate for a while, so you could actually make it worse. But it's very hard to predict because there are so many nonlinear feedback loops and they all interact with each other in highly complex ways. So we could be looking at something that could get significantly worse, but there are so many things that we don't know that it's very difficult to make specific quantitative predictions. That was a point that I was raising in the essay. Not that there isn't a climate issue, but that making quantitative predictions about it is more difficult than people seem to think. I mean, I hear all the time, X ppm of CO2 means that a certain number of degrees of warming are a given. And I would say, but we don't know that because it's not a linear relationship. So there are so many complicating factors besides just CO2. Methane is a huge one, for instance. But I don't think we can make specific quantitative predictions as to the number of degrees that something might rise. I think it's better to look at qualitative models that simply look at the factors that are pushing things in one direction or the other without trying to be precise to a degree that we can't actually justify with the data and the error bars.
So part of your argument about climate, as I understand it is frightening, but if we manage to transmit that righteous fear of the future due to climate change, the social reaction may not be what we want at all. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes. I mean, my view is that if we succeeded in raising awareness, especially if it was awareness based on fear, which is a really powerful driving force, I was looking in the essay at what would actually happen if we succeeded in getting that level of awareness. And my view was there are five things that were more likely than other outcomes. So there was carbon trading Ponzi schemes, which enrich the few and will probably generate large amounts of greenhouse gases because the rich will pay the poor in order to mitigate their emissions for them, but the odds of this actually being a net gain in terms of reduced emissions are very low. So that's possibility number one. There's geoengineering, which is let's throw a whole lot of particulate matter around in the atmosphere, simulate some volcanism, and then we don't actually have to change our behavior at all. We can just compensate for it. But that's an awfully large, blunt instrument to beat a system that's very delicate that we don't actually understand particularly well. It will enrich a few people significantly. The odds of it being a net benefit, I think, are very low. So, I think the potential for disaster is actually quite significant. The third possibility is huge expenditure on mitigation. Let's build a $6 billion seawall around New York City or something like that. Well, that's very carbon intensive, very energy intensive, very capital intensive, may or may not help in the long run anyway. But we know today it would put a whole lot more carbon in the atmosphere and, yet again, would enrich the few. So there's a common theme with those. The exact same problem we've had all the time, enriching the few, over-financializing things. So that's what got us into this mess in the first place. It's not what's going to get us out of it. The fourth possibility is ecofascism. And since when has fascism of any kind ever been good for the environment? So any kind of greenwash would be nothing more than that. It would be a smokescreen for wanting to control people's lives in ways that would actually make the quality of life vastly worse, and the odds of it being a net gain for the environment are nil, effectively. The fifth possibility is, let's say we've offended God or Gaia or whatever we would like to say, and we must now self-flagellate and destroy everything that we have built. So blow up dams and whatever else might follow from that. So the kinds of ideas that we must now tear down industrial civilization. I think there are huge problems with this. I think the people who are going to be hurt are the people who couldn't get out of the way. I don't see this as being a benefit. I think it's throwing away the embodied energy and infrastructure like dams when there might have been the potential to use that concentrated energy for something that's actually useful. So if the large scale is going to disappear anyway, which is something I've argued, because in an era where there's a lot less money around, a lot less energy, you can't maintain that large scale control anyway, which would mean that the benefits could actually, and in theory anyway, accrue to lower levels of society, but not if we've blown them up. If we blow up infrastructure, we're just going to take a one-way trip to the Stone Age in the most violent way possible. And how on earth is that a benefit? Then people will cut down every last tree and burn it because they won't have anything else to keep warm. I look at these five possibilities and I say every one of them is going to make it worse. But those are by far the most likely outcomes if we suddenly all took up the notion that climate change was the only thing that mattered. Because all of them are going to make it worse, I would say if we want to do something about climate change, don't try and raise public awareness in a simplistic way where all you will do is feed the fear. Say, what would actually make a difference? Well, financial crash will make a difference, as Holmgren was arguing. I would say we shouldn't try and precipitate it because we don't need to. It's going to happen anyway. And why should we take the blame for it if there's any chance we might avoid that? So we're going to have financial crash. The next thing that might help with financial crash in terms of mitigating climate is to deal with our own lifestyles. So to say, if we can be more resilient, more relocalized, deal with our own supplies of essentials, if there's any way that we can, if more of us are doing that, then that will have a knock-on effect on reduced emissions. And it will also insulate us to some extent from financial crash. So what motivates people to make those local decisions, those personal individual decisions? Well, it's not large-scale global issues because those are disempowering. If you see everything in global terms, you end up thinking that there's nothing you can do that will make a difference. So I tell people to do, for reasons of peak oil and financial crisis, the exact same things that people like David Holmgren or Rob Hopkins are telling people to do for reasons of climate change. But I would say if you cast the argument in terms of financial crisis and peak oil, people will actually do it. Because it's personal and it's immediate. You get the psychological drivers right. It's a more effective way of dealing with climate change, even although it never actually mentions it.
So where does permaculture fit into this? I know you're heading to Belize to teach a course about permaculture. Why don't you tell us about that and give us an insight on how that fits into this overall scheme?
It's a regenerative agriculture system, a design process that builds towards a regenerative agriculture system. So you're rebuilding soil fertility. You're rebuilding the capacity to provide food from a local area and a lot more food than you would have if you went down the route of wipe out an ecosystem, create biomass, a monoculture of biomass, all for human consumption. Even if you did that organically, like they did, say, in the early days of the Fertile Crescent, even if it was entirely organic, when you have an agricultural system that exists to eliminate an ecosystem and turn it into human biomass as quickly as possible, you are on a trajectory of ever-increasing expansion. So agriculture, even organic agriculture done in that way, leaves deserts in its wake, as it did in the Fertile Crescent. Permaculture is about working with natural systems, mimicking natural systems, using ecosystem services of animals, using plants to fill particular niches, putting things together that go together and support each other. So you have ecological guilds, for instance, and then being part of that system as humans rather than being on top of it or trying to turn it only to human advantage. It provides human advantage, but it provides a lot of advantages for ecosystems as well. We can actually regenerate very damaged ecosystems, and that allows us to increase or maintain, at least, carrying capacity. With carrying capacity, it's going to be a huge issue. We have overextended ourselves in terms of carrying capacity. Even we've overextended ourselves beyond the artificial carrying capacity that fossil fuels gave us. We are going to have a very large carrying capacity issue when we have a lot less fossil fuels around, and we have strip mined soil fertility, so we're going to find we have a big problem. Regenerative agriculture, which is a big part of permaculture, is a very good way of addressing this so that we can get more people through a bottleneck and mitigate the suffering of going through that bottleneck. So limits to growth are going to impose some very large non-negotiable limits, and we're not going to like it one bit. But we can mitigate the impact. We can try to come through the other side, having preserved a certain amount of knowledge and capacity to act with our environment. And I think the more we can be humble and learn from natural systems that have had thousands and tens and hundreds of thousands of years to practice what they do, the more we can learn from that rather than thinking all the time that we know better, then the better our chances in the future. And permaculture is a huge part of that.
You're making a lot of sense, and I know we've missed some of the key thoughts that you raised in your article, Crash on Demand, a response to David Holmgren. I think people need to get together maybe once a week and start talking this through, because it's difficult. We have to deprogram our brains. I'm wondering if your DVD set can help. Why don't you tell people how they can get that?
Well, the most recent DVD set was from September of 2013. It's myself and Lawrence Bomert. It was primarily focused on finance and community initiatives. So I did a global financial update, and then Lawrence did a whole piece on community initiatives, local currencies, and local currencies mitigate the artificial scarcity of a liquidity crunch, which is where financial crisis is taking us. So they're a very important aspect of preparing. And then we did a joint presentation on the fortunes for municipal government, looking at the crisis for municipal debt and the reinvention of civic leadership, given that in an era when we have less energy, the largest operable scale is going to be a lot smaller. So we wanted to focus on municipal government, see if there was anything we could do to get that scale actually working so we could have a top-down, bottom-up partnership where the top was municipal and the bottom is all the grassroots initiatives. So that series of DVDs is called Facing the Future. That's available on our website. If people are more interested in the energy issues, that would be on our older DVD set, which was A World of Change. Each of them is of the order of 4 hours long, but they cover completely different kinds of material.
Our guest has been Nicole Foss. She's the co-editor of the popular financial blog, theautomaticearth.com, where she writes a stone lay. You can find links to all the works we've talked about today in my show blog at ecoshock.info, published every Wednesday. Nicole, I really appreciate you're such a spark plug. Thank you for sharing your time and your mind.
You're very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I'd like to give you a quick insider tip for loyal Radio EcoShock listeners. I'm concerned about the latest reports in the media that the sun is entering, or at least experiencing, a period of minimum solar activity. Hardly any solar storms or sunspots are happening. This could develop into a relative cooling influence. A similar period, that went on for years from the 1550s to the 1850s, brought several lengthy cold periods called the Little Ice Age. Rivers in Europe froze over, crops were affected, and so on. If we encounter a diminution of solar power, say for a decade or three, that might modify the true amount of warming latent in the atmosphere from our greenhouse gases. The climate deniers would have a field day. Predictions of 4 degrees by 2035 would be laughed at, and we would squander that time to decarbonize, adding more tons and tons of carbon equivalent to the atmosphere. And then, when the sun inevitably heats up, we might experience a few decades of active solar storms. We would be cooked. We don't know, and nobody knows, if the quiet sun is just part of a normal 11-year cycle, or whether we are entering a longer period. Let's pray for the return of sunspots, my friend, so fickle humans can experience the current reality rather than coasting into a doom which we might do anyway. I think this is one of the reasons why people like Nicole Foss say predicting actual amount of climate change based on the tons of carbon that go into the atmosphere every year is very hard to do. There are so many things that could change quickly or that might work out in the long term. We just don't know. We can't make those predictions accurately. What we do know is we're having violent storms, we're having very strange weather, and we've just started on this path towards climate change. I disagree with Nicole. I think we need to talk about this, and we need to talk about it long and loud. We are talking about whether humans will have a future and what it will be. I encourage you to download this program from my website, ecoshock.org. It's free. Listen again, and please pass on the show or the links to everyone you know. This has to get out far and wide while there is still time, if there is still time. I count on you to make this particular show sing out on the net, on social media, and through all personal contact. Get it out there, please. My special thanks to the nonprofit station relaying Radio EcoShock to you. Please support your local community radio. You make Radio EcoShock possible through your financial support for this program, too, via my website, ecoshock.org, or my show blog at ecoshock.info. Check out that blog for links mentioned in this program so you can follow up and grow with me. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. I'm going to go out with my pathetic attempt to write new climate music. It's called Burning Down the Future.
Traveling around, big fire burning down my home. Down a brain or heart attack, ain't no point going back. Burning down the future, flooding out the past. Lies, bugs, no one knows, nothing here would last. Met that girl from nowhere, moved out by her flames. Went up north and west, it was all the same. I say burning down the future, flooding out the past. Lies, bugs, no one knows, nothing here will last. Love is good, love is real, people have a heart. Hungry folks, they may steal, looking for a star. Looking for a star, searching for lost times. I lost yours, you lost mine, keep on moving down the line. Burned out brush, camping squats, we're all peasants now. Oil is gold, water sold, we ain't got none anyhow. Burning down the future, flooding out the past. Lies, bugs, no one knows, nothing here will last. This may not be your life yet, surely isn't mine. But all will be told as it comes in the truth of time. In the truth of time, in the truth of time, in the truth of time. Future, flooding out the past. Lies, bugs, no one knows, nothing here will last. Burning down the future, flooding out the past. Lies, bugs, no one knows, nothing here will last.